Now let's examine the anomalies around the last plane, United Airlines Flight 93, that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, reportedly at 10:03 a.m. and 20 minutes away from Washington. The official story made me proud to be an American. The passengers overcame the hijackers and sacrificed their lives so that others might be spared. Back to Charles Lewis again at LAX that morning. They said fighter jets had been scrambled from two different military bases and that they had shot down the plane over Pennsylvania. And that was way before we got the hero story. The first news reports expressed surprise at how little debris was visible at the crash site. The Pennsylvania State website even said it was hard to believe that a 757 plunged into the ground with such force that it literally disintegrated and created a still smoldering crater in the ground. Then 5 days later, CNN News reported, apparently another debris site that had been cordoned off 6 to 8 miles away. This, the commentator said, raises a number of questions. Why? Could it have blown that far away? The FBI immediately took over the investigation, and for a long time wouldn't honor family members' requests asking if they could listen to the cockpit voice recorder. This was finally allowed on April 18, 2002, provided they'd agree not to reveal anything about what they heard. And for some reason, the last 3 minutes weren't on there. Barry Lichty, the mayor of the nearby town of Indian Lake, says he heard what sounded like a missile fire that morning. The military did admit some years later that it was tracking Flight 93, and a Colonel Robert Marr recalled hearing that we will take lives in the air to preserve lives on the ground. He then ordered the air controllers to have fighter jets intercept the plane, but supposedly the commercial flight crashed before that could happen. Of course, we never fired upon the plane, said Dick Cheney. We just witnessed an act of heroism. The official story is that for the first time in history, the black boxes were not recovered, not from any of the four planes. For the TV pilot I did about 9/11 on True TV, we spoke to a guy who knew about the existence of three black boxes. He physically saw one, and his partner saw two more. He says they were taken away in a black government van. Another thing I find interesting, also for the first time in history, no attempt was made to reconstruct the planes with whatever parts they could find. They even did this with TWA Flight 800 that went down in 1996 in the Atlantic, and for that they had to dive down 1,200 feet. After Pearl Harbor, General Martin Short and some admirals were fired because of their alleged negligence. After 9/11, not a single employee at the FAA or NORAD got punished. In fact, all the major military men involved received promotions. They included General Richard Myers, who was named chairman of the Joint Chiefs on October 1st. The way I see it, with all the advance warnings about a terrorist attack, a fair number of Bush's team should have gotten the axe. Except right up to the president himself, it was all about denial. Here was Bush in 2004. Had I any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes into buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country. Here was Rumsfeld testifying before the 9/11 Commission. I knew of no intelligence during the 6+ months leading up to September 11th to indicate terrorists would hijack commercial airlines, use them as missiles to fly into the Pentagon or the World Trade Center towers. And here was Condoleezza Rice. This kind of analysis about the use of airplanes as weapons actually was never briefed to us. Oh, really? What about the intelligence briefing Bush received on August 6, 2001, that was headed, Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., and even mentioned possible hijackings? Or Condi Rice being warned about al-Qaeda's plotting by then-CIA Director George Tenet on July 10, 2001, but brushing him off? The 9/11 Commission was aware of this, but decided to leave it out of their report. The CIA's counterintelligence chief, J. Kofor Black, later felt there were things the commission wanted to know about and things they didn't want to know about. Rice responded, "What I am quite certain of is that I would remember if I was told, as this account apparently says, that there was about to be an attack in the United States, and the idea that I would somehow have ignored that I find incomprehensible." Seems she stammered over her words a little. These were far from the only warnings. Israel sent two senior agents of the Mossad to Washington in August 2001 to alert the CIA and FBI to the existence of a cell of as many as 200 terrorists said to be preparing a big operation. 8 months before the attacks, French intelligence warned the U.S. in 9 different reports about airplane hijacking plans by radical Islamists connected to bin Laden and the Taliban. FBI agents working out of the Minneapolis and Phoenix offices tried to alert their superiors. Dr. Park Godfrey, an associate professor of computer science at Toronto's York University, said under oath in a New York courtroom that a longtime associate of his, Susan Lindauer, warned him several times, and as late as August 2001, that we expected a major attack on the southern part of Manhattan, and that the attack would encompass the World Trade Center, an attack that would involve airplanes and possibly a nuclear weapon. Lindauer, who says she was a CIA asset, claimed to have made an attempt to inform John Ashcroft at the Justice Department, who referred her to the Office of Counterterrorism. Which brings us to the whole question of the 19 alleged hijackers. Did you ever wonder how our government came up with their identities so fast? Even before the last plane crashed, the FBI was telling counterterrorism official Richard Clark they had a list of the names. It took 2 years to get indictments on the Lockerbie bombing, but not this time. Except on September 16th, one of the supposed hijackers walked into the consulate in Saudi Arabia. He was actually a pilot for Saudi Airlines. On September 22nd, one of the Flight 11 hijackers announced he was alive and well. 2 more Saudi pilots did the same thing the next day. On September 27th, CBS found hijacker Hamzi, Flight 77, working for an oil refinery in Saudi Arabia. No matter, all these guys are still on the list today as being among the perpetrators. What evidence do we have, then? 2 days after the attacks, our government said it was clear-cut that Osama bin Laden was the man behind it all, and that the Taliban in Afghanistan would soon be handing over its proof. 10 more days went by, at which time Colin Powell said he'd soon show us the documentation. Meantime, in 3 separate statements, bin Laden denied any involvement. On December 13th, the State Department released a video purporting to show him describing the attacks, but before long a lot of people were questioning whether it was authentic. On the day after Christmas, a Taliban official said he'd attended Osama's funeral, but on the 27th of December came a bin Laden video praising al-Qaeda's successful hit on us. Another couple of years went by before a third tape surfaced, October 29, 2004, a few days before the presidential election. Think heightened terror alert, with a blatant taking of full responsibility. However, as of June 6, 2006, the FBI said it had no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. He's been charged with several crimes related to terrorist attacks, but not with 9/11. I find that very odd. Not one shred of evidence produced in a courtroom that leads to the conclusion bin Laden spearheaded these attacks. The justice system that works for anything else is suddenly suspended over terrorism. We are led to believe that a hijacker's passport flew out of his pocket when his plane hit the tower, made it safely through 9,000 gallons of jet fuel, and landed to be found on a sidewalk 1,000 feet below. Another hijacker's ID supposedly turned up in the Pentagon wreckage. one of the few pieces that survived. Meantime, awaiting discovery in rental cars left behind at Boston Logan and Washington Dulles airports was enough evidence to convict, had they lived, an Arabic flight manual, a check made out to a Phoenix flight school, maps of Washington and New York, and more. Does this remind anyone else of Oswald leaving behind a paper trail to his purchase of the rifle, or James Earl Ray depositing his bundle full of incriminating evidence near the scene of the crime? Alleged hijacker Mohammed Atta was first said to have left a rented Mitsubishi at Boston Logan, but that story was later changed into a blue or silver Nissan left in Portland, Maine. Didn't seem to matter which vehicle, because both were said to be filled with box cutters and other incriminating items. These guys were all made out to be fanatic, Koran-toting Muslims ready to die for Allah in a holy war against America. Except in their final days, according to people who knew them, they were drinking, visiting strip clubs, soliciting prostitutes, and watching porno on the tube. Atta's girlfriend said he liked to snort cocaine. Atta seemed to be all over the place before 9/11, doing coke in Hollywood, Florida, living in Venice, Florida, near the NSA, and they were drinking, visiting strip clubs, soliciting prostitutes, and watching porno on the tube. Atta's girlfriend said he liked to snort cocaine. Atta seemed to be all over the place before 9/11, doing coke in Hollywood, Florida, living in Venice, Florida, near the NSA, and in Hamburg, Germany. Who some of the hijackers were really working for, at least once upon a time, first came out in media tidbits. From Newsweek, September 15, 2001. U.S. military sources have given the FBI information that suggests five of the alleged hijackers of the planes that were used in the terror attacks received training at secure U.S. military installations in the 1990s. Same day. New York Times. The Defense Department said Mr. Atta had gone to the International Officer School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, Mr. Al Omari to the Aerospace Medical School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas, and Mr. Al Ghamdi to the Defense Language Institute at the Presidio in Monterey, California. Well, our military's School of the Americas once helped train the Central American death squads, so are providing lethal skills to terrorists, freedom fighters, shouldn't come as a huge surprise. But it gets stranger still. Two of the alleged hijackers rented an apartment from, and actually lived with, FBI informants. The CIA had operational interest in two of them, Nawaz al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. FBI agents believed that the agency was protecting Midhar and Hazmi because it hoped to recruit them, or, alternatively, that the CIA was running a joint venture with Saudi intelligence using them. The CIA goes way back with these guys. They were recruited into the secret war against the Soviets in Afghanistan back in the late 1980s. In fact, the term Al-Qaeda is said to have been invented by the CIA to designate a database of recruits into the Mujahideen. Michael Springman was head of the visa section at our embassy in Jeddah from 1987 to 1989, and he remembers granting visas to terrorists who'd been recruited by CIA and sent for training to America. Some of them fought in Bosnia during the 92 to 95 period. Springman can be seen in the documentary Zero, saying that many of the hijackers he read about in the L.A. Times were once on his visa list in Jeddah. He called the FBI a number of times, who, Springman says, responded, "We'll get back to you." 6 years later, I'm still waiting. Osama bin Laden himself started out helping the CIA in Afghanistan. In 2009, a former FBI translator named Sibel Edmonds dropped a bombshell. The U.S., she said, had kept up intimate relations with bin Laden all the way until that day of September 11th, using him sometimes for ops in Central Asia, including Xinjiang, China. The process Edmonds outlined involved the use of Turkey, with assistance of actors from Pakistan and Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia, as proxies, with those folks in turn employing bin Laden and the Taliban. The goals? Control of the huge energy supplies in Central Asia, for one. Maybe the real reason we invaded Afghanistan? Sibel Edmonds testified for 3.5 hours to the 9/11 Commission, but it ended up being classified. Bin Laden, like 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers, came from Saudi Arabia. Back in October 2003, an article in Vanity Fair had questioned the FBI's letting 6 planes of Middle Eastern nationals, most of them members of the Saudi royal family, fly out of the U.S. soon after 9/11. The 9/11 Commission concluded that, after the Saudi government requested this out of fear for their safety, the FBI had conducted a satisfactory screening of Saudi nationals who left the United States. But one of those planes stopped 4 times at different locations around the U.S. on September 19th, picking up half-siblings and other bin Laden relatives who supposedly had no connection to him. Finally, in 2007, a heavily censored FBI report said the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royal family or Osama bin Laden. Osama? You mean to tell me the ringleader of the 9/11 attacks might have been chartering a plane on our soil 8 days after this happened? It just gets curiouser and curiouser, in the words of Lewis Carroll from Alice in Wonderland. FBI Director Robert Mueller testified about how the terrorists managed to finance themselves, saying that they'd had all their money wired in small amounts to avoid being detected. Except it came out that General Mahmoud Ahmad, the head of Pakistan's ISI intelligence service, had ordered one of his agents to wire transfer $100,000 to Mohammed Atta. The ISI and the CIA's relationship dates back to the 1980s, when the Mujahideen got set up. Ahmad, as it happened, had come to Washington a week before the attacks for a meeting with CIA Chief George Tenet and some people from Bush's National Security Council. When the story came out about the wire transfer to Atta, Ahmad abruptly retired from the ISI. The families of many 9/11 victims have gone to court seeking evidence of the Saudi royal family's bankrolling of Al-Qaeda. Senator Bob Graham wrote a book that discussed the 28-page section about Saudi Arabia that the CIA, FBI, and NSA had blacked out of his committee's report. In the book, Graham noted ties between the hijackers and the Saudis and flatly stated that the White House was directing the cover-up to protect America's relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Ever heard of an army project called Able Danger? It was established in 1999 as part of the Defense Department's Special Operations Command, SOCOM. According to Colonel Anthony Schaefer, a leading member of the team with the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, Able Danger was an offensive counterterrorism project which was designed to take and kill, the military term is reduce, senior Al-Qaeda leadership. It wasn't long before the Able Danger squad uncovered Al-Qaeda cells in the New York City area, one of whose members was Mohammed Atta. At least 6 witnesses later recalled seeing Atta's picture on a chart they'd drawn up back in January 2000. Turns out, 3 more of the alleged hijackers had been ID'd by Able Danger before 9/11 as well. Colonel Schaefer worked closely with Navy Captain Scott Philpott and says he attempted to set up a meeting between Philpott's superior officer and FBI counterterrorism agents in D.C., so they could work together on following these cells. But 3 times, the SOCOM lawyers kept a meeting from happening. Soon after that, Schaefer got transferred to a DIA project in Latin America. Then, after 9/11, he and Philpott tried to bring the story forward to Congress and the 9/11 Commission. In June 2005, a reporter for a small-town Pennsylvania paper wrote a piece that opened with, 2 years before the September 11, 2001 attacks, U.S. intelligence officials linked Mohammed Atta to al-Qaeda and discovered he and two others were in Brooklyn. You might think the national media would have jumped all over that, but they didn't. Eventually, the New York Times did a few stories, but when the 9/11 Commission came up with reasons for leaving Able Danger out of its report, the media nodded off again. Chairman Thomas Kane went so far as to say that the recollections of the intelligence officers cannot be verified by any document. Hence, it didn't happen. And the Pentagon wouldn't let Schaefer or anyone else testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We talked to Schaefer while putting together this chapter. In his opinion, both the Clinton and Bush administrations were covering up their incompetence. The Department of Defense does not want to get blamed for making bad decisions, which resulted in information not being passed to the FBI and therefore being a material factor in why 9/11 happened, he told us. That's why you had DOD coming after me, because I blew the whistle. DOD has admitted there are 10,000-plus Able Danger documents, but they won't release a single one. To me, that's bizarre, because most of the targeting information was done on the open Internet and completely unclassified. It does cause you to wonder. 9/11 expert David Ray Griffin concluded that the Commission and the Pentagon were covering up dangerous information, information that suggested Atta was being protected. When we combine this observation with other things we have learned about the alleged hijackers, including the money reportedly sent to Atta by the CIA-created Pakistani ISI, the Able Danger evidence provides additional reason to suspect that the hijackers were really paid assets. A think tank called the Project for the New American Century, composed mainly of right-wing ideologues, wrote a report pre-9/11 titled Building America's Defenses. The document contains this line. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. We all know the results of 9/11. Two unending wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Remember the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964? We were told that American ships were attacked by the North Vietnamese. Now we know that the incident was manufactured by the Pentagon in order to gain support for escalating the Vietnam War. If the United States government was prepared to stage such a gargantuan event in leading our nation to war, then why would they refrain from doing so again today? Might we look at this as a trend, going into these wars under false pretenses? Richard A. Clark, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism at the time, wrote in 2009 that Iraq was a move that many senior Bush officials had wanted to make before 9/11. While the Pentagon was still burning, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld was in the White House suggesting an attack against Baghdad, despite being repeatedly told that Iraq was not involved in 9/11, some, like Cheney, could not abandon the idea. The 9/11 Commission report states that the Bush administration had repeatedly tied the Iraq War to September 11th. The panel finds no al-Qaeda-Iraq tie. Bush then did some backpedaling, saying, "This administration never said that the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. We did say there were numerous contacts." Meetings, it turned out, between bin Laden and Iraqi intelligence that took place in Sudan back in the mid-1990s. But one prisoner, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, was tortured in 2002 until he'd agreed to say that al-Qaeda was linked to Saddam. He died suddenly after being transferred from Egypt to another prison in Libya. The 9/11 Commission was a whitewash from the front. After Bush and Cheney had stonewalled an investigation for more than a year. The fellow named as the first commission chairman was none other than Henry Kissinger, who said no thank you on December 13, 2002, when told that he'd have to disclose his list of private business clients. Kissinger was also busy advising the Bush administration on how best to go into Iraq. The commission's executive director ended up being Philip Zelikow, who got a jump on the game by putting together a detailed outline of the final report just as they were starting to investigate. The outline was kept secret from others on the 80-member staff. Zelikow decided everything. After all, back in 1998, he'd co-written an essay on catastrophic terrorism, which he foresaw would be a watershed event in American history. Like Pearl Harbor, this event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures, scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. Sound familiar? Zelikow had also been principal author of a paper aimed at justifying a preemptive strike on Iraq, and he tried without success to insert a sentence into the report suggesting repeated communication between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Zelikow happened to leave off his resume the fact that at Condi Rice's request he'd been part of the Bush transition team. But then he'd co-authored a book with Rice, too. Zelikow engaged in surreptitious communications with Karl Rove in the course of the investigation. With Zelikow running the show, there was no hope that the commission would carry out an impartial investigation. It recently came out that there were minders from Bush's team sitting there with the witnesses, answering questions for them and positioning themselves physically in an intimidating manner. The 9/11 Commission politely informs us that conspiracy theories play a peculiar role in American discourse. Whenever there is a particularly surprising, traumatic, and influential moment in our history, people are left with unsettling questions. As an example, they go on to cite conspiracy theorists who propagate outrageous notions that Kennedy was assassinated by the CIA or some shadowy secret society of the rich and powerful. Outrageous notions? I find it outrageous that yet another government-appointed commission allows itself to become part of the cover-up, especially when they knew damn well that's what they were doing. The 10-member commission, in a secret meeting at the end of its tenure in summer 2004, debated referring the matter to the Justice Department for criminal investigation, according to several commission sources. Staff members and some commissioners thought that emails and other evidence provided enough probable cause to believe that military and aviation officials violated the law by making false statements to Congress and to the commission. The 9/11 Commission's chairman, Thomas Kane, and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton have since come out and said, "The recent revelations that the CIA destroyed videotape interrogations of Qaeda operatives leads us to conclude that the agency failed to respond to our lawful requests for information about the 9/11 plot. Those who knew about those videotapes and did not tell us about them obstructed our investigation." Now we know from the new book by senior counsel John Farmer that almost every person involved in the official version of 9/11 lied about the events of that day. Our country has changed since 9/11. We've been frightened into half the people saying torture's okay now if it prevents terrorism. Americans are marching in the streets to try to stop someone who's sick from going to the doctor. But where is the outcry now that it's been proven that the whole Iraq war was trumped up? Maybe something stopped in us all on 9/11, and we're stuck back there collectively and can't truly move forward until we have a new independent investigation to get to the bottom of what really happened. The 9/11 Truth Movement has a growing of groups: political leaders, architects and engineers, firefighters, lawyers, medical professionals, pilots, religious leaders, scholars, scientists, journalists, and other media and veterans. Check them out online. Get involved, as I have. But if you challenge the status quo, be prepared for retaliation. That's what seems to have happened to Charles Lewis, the man with whom we began this chapter's revelations. After he noticed another lapse at LAX as a quality control manager, this time observing a Saudi Airlines 747 disembark a host of passengers into the cargo area, his security clearance got revoked. He's currently unemployed. What should we do now? When enough people came to question the Warren Commission, the door was open for Congress to do a further investigation and come to a different conclusion about the Kennedy assassination. That should be precedent enough, now that it's become clear the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash, for Americans to call for a new and honest investigation into the greatest attack ever perpetrated on our soil. Was our own government asleep at the switch? Or might it even have played a role in what happened? It's time to demand an answer, as independent truth-seeking groups from many walks of life are already calling for.